I love the fact that the Democrats are running around calling Trump a threat to democracy when the Democrats are going to have a nominee who never ran in a primary, not one. She never got one vote, but she's going to be the nominee. People say, what would a Harris administration look like? She'll be Biden on steroids.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Paradigm Press's YouTube channel. My name is Sean Ring. I am the editor of The Rood Awakening. It's great to be back with the one and only Jim Rickards. We're going to talk about a couple of Jim's predictions that have, of course, come to fruition. What I want to kick it off with, Mr. Rickards, is the Fed. If you recall, when we were in Watergate together at the whiskey bar, I said they were going to cut in June, and you said I was crazy, and you were correct. And besides being annoyed about that, if you'll indulge me just for a second, wouldn't it have been so much easier if Jay Powell just cut that and then he's out of the conversation until the inauguration? Now the Fed is expected to do something, even if they do nothing between now and November, and the markets are looking a little bit jittery over it. What's your take on that?
Well, that's a nice five-part compound question, so let me deconstruct it a little bit. We'll see what we can make of that. The first thing is, I think, as an analyst, Sean, you always have to separate what the Fed should do from what they will do, because they're always wrong. So if you could have a really acute, astute analysis on what they should do, I would say they should have cut rates maybe a year ago, or at least stopped raising. Well, they did stop raising them, but maybe should have begun cutting them last fall, if not sooner, because the U.S. economy is very clearly heading into a recession. But that's my view. I can defend it, but it's not my forecast. My forecast is you have to put yourself in the other guy's shoes. You have to basically act like Jay Powell or think like Jay Powell and use that as the basis of saying, what is he going to do? So on that basis, it was very clear to me that they were not going to cut rates in June. I can promise you they're not going to cut rates in July. So that's a foregone conclusion. The July 31st FOMC announcement will be no change. So what we're really talking about in terms of forecasting is September. The Fed has a crazy schedule. They meet 8 times a year, not 12, not 4, not 2, just 8 times. Doesn't sync up with maybe the lunar calendar. I don't know, but that's what they do. So as a result, there are certain months with no meetings, and there is no meeting in August. They have this July 31st meeting. The next meeting is at the end of September. I don't have the exact date in front of me. It's around September 19th or 20th, right around there. Then there's no meeting in October, and then they have meetings in November and December. But importantly, the November meeting comes after the election. So if you want to put a political twist on this or introduce that as a factor, and I think that's a good idea, you can say, hey, the election is November 5th. The next FOMC meeting is early November, and then there's one in mid-December. At that point, the Fed's in the clear. The election's over. Whoever won, they won. Nobody can accuse the Fed of electoral interference. No meeting in August, no meeting in October, so you get a bye on those 2 months. So that, it all boils down to the September meeting. The problem with the September meeting, it is exactly approximately 5 weeks, maybe even closer to 6 weeks before the election. That's really close to the election. Whatever the arguments are, whatever the macroeconomic condition, absent a crisis, if there's a crisis or stock market falls 30%, in the first 2 weeks of September, which you can't rule out, okay, they'll cut rates and they'll do what they have to do. But absent that kind of extreme market action, the Fed runs the risk of cutting rates just weeks before the election, which will be viewed as very favorable to Kamala Harris, the presumptive Democratic nominee, very favorable to the Democratic Party. Trump has already said, don't do it. Don't go there. Now, Trump's not the chairman of the Fed, although maybe he gets to decide who the next chairman of the Fed actually is. Well, he does if he wins. But Trump has already said, don't go there. That's tilting the playing field. That's political bias. That's political interference. Leave it alone. Call me in November. And several powerful committee chairs in the House of Representatives, which, of course, are controlled by the Republicans, have said the same thing. Like this, don't do it. The Fed claims to be non-political. That's nonsense. I mean, they claim it. They put on a very good show of it. They say the right things. They keep, if you ask Jay Powell pointed question about politics, so it's not my job. It's not what we do. That's nonsense. They're highly political, always have been. I'm not saying this is the main driver or the only driver, but it's certainly one driver, one thing you have to factor in. So on the one hand, the signs of a recession, I've been calling for a long time, as have others. This is a kind of a slow motion recession. The signs are ample, whether it's some of them are fairly technical, but yield curves are uninverting, which is interesting because they invert, meaning short-term rates are higher than long-term rates. That's the opposite of a normal yield curve. Normal yield curve, long-term rates are higher than short-term rates. The yield curve goes like this. And the idea is, hey, if I'm going to lend you money for a month or a year, I might want a certain interest rate, but if I'm going to lend you money for 10 years, I want a higher rate because there's more risk and, you know, inflation and default, et cetera, et cetera. But sometimes yield curves invert, meaning the short-term rates are, they go like this, which is, it happens, but it's not normal. And so what is the yield curve telling you when it inverts? It's telling you that the smart money, the big money, expect a recession or at best a slowdown, at worst a recession, maybe something worse than that. Cause, you know, you can get 5.5% until recently on a 6-month treasury bill, which is a very safe instrument, versus maybe 4.75% on a 10-year treasury note. Well, why would you take the lower rate on the treasury note? Well, the answer is that a year from now, that the yield to maturity on a newly issued treasury note might be 2%. But that, why would that happen? What would happen if you were in a severe recession, unemployment went up to 6 or 7%? So that 4.5% or 4.75% could look really smart a year from now, if the market was at 2%, not only would you have that higher coupon locked in for 10 years, but you'd have a huge capital gain on the instrument if you felt like selling it. Meanwhile, in the very short run, short term, inflation is still a problem. So that's where you get these inverted yield curves, where inflation is a problem, but looks like recession is on the way, and so it actually slopes down. Just to take that a step further, if everyone's still with me, when you get closer to the actual recession, or when you're actually in it, you get what's called a bull steepener. What happens then? The 10-year note doesn't move a lot, but the short-term rate starts to come down a lot. And the yield curve gets uninverted, gets a normal slope at a much lower level on the short end. That's a sign that you're actually in the recession. Now the forecast the rates were going to come down has actually started to play out. And the rates actually are coming down. So that's, and there are a lot of other indicators, negative swap spreads and so forth. But what it all means is that the economy is weakening, maybe in a recession already, maybe that's highly likely. And Powell should cut rates, should have cut them already. I put a lot more weight on this political factor than most others. I mean, the Fed does think long-term. I don't mean in terms of interest rate policy, that's like an overnight rate, but they don't want to be politicized. They internally, they're political, but they don't want to be on the political radar screen inside the Beltway and in the media. And so they'll likely, I think, duck this one and not try to do something that would just bring the wrath of Khan down on them. I mean, do they really want to be the center of a political debate for the last, you know, 6 weeks before the election, led by Trump and his spokespeople, versus just waiting another month and then cutting the rates after the election? That's the decision they have to make. There's even a little more to it than that, which is inflation has not gone away. Everyone thinks it has. Every one of these Fed meetings, you know, the 8 times a year, I do a pre-Fed report and a post-action report. So we sent out the Fed meeting today. We sent out a bulletin a couple of days ago. Said the Fed's not going to cut rates, so that's an easy one. But I don't expect a rate cut in September either, for the political reasons, but I also give an inflation chart. And everyone was very excited. So the most recent inflation data we have was for June. We got that number in early July. We don't have the July number yet. We'll get that, you know, next week or the week after in early August. But we had the June number, and it was 3%, and that was down from May. By the way, I'm talking about headline CPI. I don't really look at all these other things. I know what they are. I understand them. But you will say, well, forget headline. What about core? Well, core, you know, core CPI takes out energy and food. The two things most people spend most of their money on, takes them out. And then some egghead invented what they call super core. Well, what's super core? Super core takes out energy, food, and housing. So if you live in a tent and drink water from a stream and pick berries, maybe that's for you, but for normal people, you know, almost 100% of their income, maybe more if they're going into debt, goes for energy, food, and housing, home eating, gas in the car, and everything else. I say the people who invent those things don't have enough to do. That's why we get them. But I understand them. I understand the statistics. I understand seasonal adjustment. I'm aware of them, but I don't give them any weight in terms of evaluating the Fed, and certainly not the voters, and certainly not consumer attitudes. because CPI headline is as close as we get to what people actually pay. Now, nobody buys the whole basket every month. I understand that. But that's as close as you can get to a real world inflation. That's what people know. So that's what I look at when I'm doing forecasting. So it went from 3.1% in May to 3% in June. And everyone's like, hey, hallelujah, inflation's under control. It's coming down. You know, some of these other metrics I mentioned are a little lower than that. But go look at June 2023, 13 prints ago. It was 3.
Right.
In other words, inflation hasn't moved in 13 months. Now it's going up and down, but it's in a range. The high range, the high part of the range was August, September 2023. It hit 7%. But even as early as earlier this year, it was 3.4, 3.5%. Okay, now it's 3%. But that's exactly where it was 12 months ago, but 13 data points counting the beginning and the end. So inflation hasn't budged at all. So, you know, this is like that, remember in the Iraq war, Bush went to that aircraft carrier in the Gulf and they had the big banner mission accomplished. Turns out like the greatest massacres of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis had just begun. And we had to like start the war over with the surge to get things a little bit under control. So this is like the Fed or the market putting up a mission accomplished sign. And one more data point, Sean, which is there is a Fed funds futures contract traded on the CME. It's legitimate. I mean, it reflects a market consensus. And you can look at it and basically derive a probability of a Fed rate cut in September.
Yeah.
So right now, the market, based on the Fed fund futures, is giving the probability of a rate cut in September about 100%. I think it's like 99, whatever. But the other day, it was actually 100%. So like, hey, wait a second, Jim. The market, meaning all these future traders, et cetera, are saying there's a 100% chance of a rate cut in September. And you're saying no. And my rebuttal to that is, okay, take the 2-month forward Fed funds futures curve every month, 2 months forward for the last 3 years, and compare it to the following FOMC meeting. It has been wrong every time, single time. So, like, well, what's up with the futures contract? The futures contract is what it is, you know, knock yourself out. But its predictive analytic value is pretty close to zero, even though its forecast is 100% chance of a rate cut. There are reasons for that. John Maynard Keynes said, when you're judging a beauty contest, don't pick the prettiest contestant. Pick the one that everyone else thinks is going to be the prettiest contestant, and you'll more likely be right. You're more likely to be right. So the Fed funds futures contract, who's in it? Well, you know, a lot of institutions and dealers and hedge funds and individuals and et cetera, but they're all following the Wall Street narrative. Yeah. Well, what's the Wall Street narrative? Soft landing, Goldilocks, perfect world. The Fed gets it, and they're going to cut rates in September. Well, okay, when did that narrative start? Started in the late summer of 2022. Remember, the Fed started raising rates in March 2022. It was only about 6 months later, around September, October 2022, that they said, okay, the Fed's going to pivot. Remember pivot? And then they were going to pivot in early 2023. Well, we get to January. Well, they're going to pivot in the middle of 2023. We get to that. They're going to pivot at the end of 2023. And they kept extending, moving the goalposts. And then it was going to be 2024. Here we are in the summer of 2024, and they're still talking about Fed rate cuts. They've been wrong for 2 years. The Fed funds futures curve has been wrong for 2 years. So it's not as if I don't listen to them or don't pay attention. I do. I factor it in. But when you're wrong for 2 years, I'm guessing you might be wrong again in September. So that's part of how I think about it. To me, the key driver, almost the only driver, except for the political twist I mentioned, is inflation. And headline CPI is just not going down. It went down month over month, but it's happened before, but it's exactly what it was 13 months ago. And so the Fed, if you actually listen to Jay Powell, because they always have buzzwords. I know the guy who writes the buzzwords, by the way. He's not on the Board of Governors. He's a real insider, but he's the guy. He's not a PR guy. He's an economist, actually writes these things.
Only an economist could.
Only an economist could, right? And I have some insight into his thing. I had to talk to him. I know him. And his PhD thesis advisor was George Akerlof, who's Janet Yellen's husband. Akerlof won a Nobel Prize for figuring out that used car salesmen know more about the cars than the customers. Thanks, George. we've been thinking that for 100 years. You proved it. So he's a big brain. I'm not making fun of him, but I'm just this, that's how he kind of rolls in Nobel Prizes in economics. As I said, inflation is not under control. Unemployment's ticked up a little bit, but job creation, at least under the employer survey, the employment survey, is still strong. It's over 200,000 a month. That doesn't sound like a recession. That gets into another quirk, which is there are two surveys. There's the employer survey and the household survey. The household survey has shown huge job losses. The employment survey shows job gains, as I said, 200,000 plus. You're like, shouldn't they be the same? I mean, you're asking two different sets of, you're asking the companies versus the calling individuals and saying, did you lose your job this month or get a job this month? They should be the same. Now, of course, there are going to be differences. And obviously, it's a survey, not 100% database. But they should kind of be the same. And when they diverge this greatly, this is an interesting thing. When they diverge to this extent, go back in history and say, well, when have they diverged before? You can find those. And what happened next? I mean, which one of them is wrong, but which one? Which one converged to the other? Well, the answer is that the household survey tends to be much more accurate, and the employer survey converges to the household survey over time. And so what that means is that the employer survey should be ready to drop off a cliff and converge with the household survey. They use a lot of games. I'm not saying they're outright lying, but you can tweak, you can play with the seasonal adjustments. You can, you know, hang up the phone if you don't like the answer. Who knows? Financial media, the financial press, the policymakers, the White House, all shout that employer survey number, that, you know, that 200,000 plus. Powell knows better. The good thing about Powell is he's not an economist. He's actually a lawyer. So lawyers are trained to look at both sides of any issue. Inside the Fed, they kind of know that there's less there than meets the eye. But it has not shown up in the inflation numbers, which is another problem because they cling desperately to the Phillips curve. So what does the Phillips curve say? The Phillips curve says if unemployment is going up, inflation is coming down. And if unemployment is going down, inflation is going up. They're just inversely related. There is zero evidence for that. Zero.
Now, just prove it in the 70s. I
mean, late 70s. Yeah, I remember that. We had 15% yields on the 30-year Treasury note and 12% unemployment. Where's your inverse correlation? They were both high. But I can show you periods where they were both low, and one was high, one was low, and then the opposite was true. Think of it as a quad chart, you know, high, low, low, high, low, 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 high, high. You can find evidence for all four, which means that there is no Phillips curve. Right. Last time I looked at one chart, it was a flat line. It wasn't much of a curve, but the Fed believes it. So when they see these high numbers in job losses from the household survey, they get there, even though they don't talk about it. They presume that inflation must be coming down, but inflation is not coming down. We already discussed that. And that tells you it's not mission accomplished. It also tells you that you may be in the worst of all possible worlds, which is stagflation. You could have a world where the economy is slowing, the recession is coming, unemployment is going up, but inflation is stubbornly high. You could be in that world, and I lived through it, in the late 1970s. So the Fed is just a mess. In that, my most recent report, I listed data for both sides. I said, here's a bunch of data that would say the Fed should cut rate. You know, gasoline prices have come down a little bit. Oil prices have come down a little bit. Job growth has slowed, even though it hasn't cratered. Unemployment's ticked up a little bit. But I also listed a long list of factors that say that inflation is not under control and the Fed should not cut rates, including some of the ones we've discussed. And so when you have that much conflicting data, the Fed's reflex is to do nothing. Just say, hey, I'm going to wait till I see it's all on one side or the other, or something that maybe, you know, the inflation I mentioned, the CPI headline went down from 3.1 to 3 in June, between May and June. Well, okay, the Fed would like to see that 3 months in a row. They'd like to see it go down to 2.8 and then 2.5. And then maybe at that point, even I would say, okay, you've broken the back of it. But I haven't seen it yet. The Fed hasn't seen it yet. I say you're entitled to your own opinion. You're not entitled to your own data. We're all looking at the same information. So I think the case for a rate cut is strong if you believe we're in a recession, which I do, but it's weak if you're solely looking at inflation and you believe in the Phillips curve, which the Fed does. So that, again, you got to put yourself in the Fed's shoes. And then throw in the political twist. I would expect no rate cut in September. Look, if there's new information between now and late September, that's a long time away. I'll revise that forecast, but that's where I am right now.
That's fair enough. I mean, and this dovetails with another prediction you made, which is correct, that we have a bull, you know, nice, real big fat rally in gold, which yeah. We have, but we've kind of stalled a little bit now. But, you know, we upped straight through 2,000, bounced on it a little bit, headed practically unimpeded to 2,400. And again, this is without that cut that everyone was waiting for. So, right. You know, what happens when they finally, or if they finally wake up and they go, all right, you know, we've slayed the inflation bull. Let's cut rates and we'll save the banks. That's another thing we'll talk about in a second. Where do you see gold going by the end of the year?
Well, to your point, Sean, and, you know, look, the ticker changes all the time, but I just took a glance at it. It's actually 2470. You're right. It got to the 2400 level and sustained that. You're absolutely right. But it's 2470, which is, I think, a tick from the all-time high. It might actually be the all-time high if it's a closing price. I think it was in intraday. It might have been 2471. That's basically an all-time high. And my view is that tells you almost nothing about gold, and it tells you a lot about the dollar. When I see a higher dollar price for gold, I don't say, oh, gee, gold's going up. What I say is, hey, the dollar's crashing. Now, you don't see that in cross rates. You don't see it against the euro, the Swiss franc, Japanese yen, Chinese yuan, the Bloomberg dollar index, DXY, which the Wall Street Journal uses. You look at every single one of those, and the dollar is very strong. You know, the yen, I debate internally, it was, oh, the yen will never get to 150. It hit 160. Remind people, when I started the banking business, the yen was 400. So I've seen this movie before. You know, the double-digit yen is not a in stone, so to speak. So yen 160 didn't surprise me. But they said, well, Jim, isn't the dollar strong? The indices are up. The other currencies are down. The cross rates favor the dollar, et cetera, et cetera. The answer is yes, if that's your measuring stick. But all you're doing is comparing one central bank currency to another central bank currency. But think of them all as survivors in a lifeboat with no food or water. I mean, they're all going down together. The point is, that's not the best way to measure dollar strength, because I can see a preference for the dollar over the euro. I can think, given a war in Ukraine, I can think of 100 reasons why that's true. Same thing with the yuan. The Chinese economy is imploding. I could favor dollars over yuan. But those are all cross rates, currency to currency. They don't tell you very much to the extent that there are common factors in all central bank currencies. If you want to know what the dollar is doing, look at gold. Gold, I'll say silver, but silver is kind of a tag along, so let's talk about gold. Gold and silver are the only forms of money that are not also forms of debt.
Right.
Like take a $20 bill out of your wallet and read it. It's actually a contract between the government and the people. I know in law school they always say read the contract. So read the contract. It says at the top, Federal Reserve note. Note is debt. And go to the Fed website, look at the balance sheet. Where's M1 or M0 or any or currency? It's on the liability side, which is a form of debt. And that's not like an earth-shaking revelation. But most people think of it as an asset. Well, it might be your asset, but it's their debt. It's government debt. Treasury note is government debt, even though they're very liquid. And you can sell them, and you can sell them to the Fed and get cash. So all forms of money are forms of debt. And debt and credit, two sides of the same coin, are the key to commerce and mercantile success, et cetera. But gold is not. Gold is a form of money, the best form in my view, but it's not a form of debt. So it has that kind of purity, no pun intended, as a yardstick, as a measuring rod, because you're not measuring with the same thing. You're using something different to measure the object. And so, again, gold at an all-time high, I say fine. Dollars at an all-time low. And that's kind of a wake-up call for people who keep talking about strong dollar, because, you know, there's that old 1969 live performance in the Montreux Jazz Festival. The song was called Compared to What? And great song. When people say, is the dollar stronger? How's the dollar doing? I say, compared to what? You know, against the euro, against the yuan, yeah, very strong. Against gold, not so much. So I would expect gold to go higher, because I would expect the dollar to continue to weaken as the U.S. Debt exceeds $35 trillion. as the U.S. debt to GDP ratio exceeds 130%, highest in history. If you said 130% debt to GDP ratio, you know, government debt's the numerator, GDP is the denominator, over 130%, who's at that lunch table? The answer is Lebanon, Greece, and our friends in Italy. It's basically the biggest super debtors in the world. And Japan, of course, is in detention. They're like 300% or something. Sorry, over 200%. Everyone says, does that mean the dollar collapses tomorrow? And the answer is no. It doesn't mean the dollar collapses tomorrow. It doesn't mean the treasury market collapses tomorrow. I say, what if the Chinese stop buying? No big deal. Just call Jamie Dimon and say, Jamie, shoot him in. You know, the banks will do what they're told. They've been trained. It doesn't mean the end of the dollar or the end of the treasury market, but it is indicative of much slower growth at best. Again, you can still have your technical recessions within a long, what's called a long depression. I would say, and others agree, that Japan has been in a depression since 1989. Yeah. Now, they've had 9 technical recessions. You know, they can't get out of it. They can't get out of the rut. They've had 9 technical recessions over those 30 plus years. No, sorry, I guess 35 years at this point. 9 technical recessions, but 1 very long depression. I would say the United States has been in a depression since 2007. Mm-hmm. Now, we've had 1 severe technical recession in 2008-2009. We had a recession that's not a recession. Don't call it a recession, said Janet Yellen, in the first 2 quarters of 2022. We had 2 consecutive quarters of declining GDP in the first half of 2022. Why was that not a recession? Because Janet Yellen said, don't call it a recession. And the National Bureau of Economic Research, which are the umpires, you know, they call the balls a strike. They haven't said so. So, okay, I guess it never happened, but the data is your GDP went down 2 quarters in a row. So count that as a mini recession. But it's been 1 long depression, particularly the episode from 2009 to 2019, when compound annual growth over that 11-year period was 2.2%. This is an economy that has potential to grow 3.5%. When you grow 2.2% in a world of 3.5% potential, that's depressed growth. By the way, that delta between 3.5 and 2.2, it's approaching $9 trillion of lost wealth if we had had policies, including lower deficits, that would have allowed that to happen. So we're trying to borrow our way out of a debt trap. It never works. The long-term result can be, probably will be, hyperinflation, but we're not there yet. But what we should expect is exactly what we're getting, which is slow growth at best and periodic recessions at worst. And I think we're probably in a recession right now. So what does that mean for gold? Well, weaker dollar measured in gold means a higher dollar price for gold. Central banks are net buyers, have been since 2010. That's continuing. Americans don't get gold. We're now into a third generation of people who have been taught nothing about gold in a monetary context. I always tell people, if you know anything about gold, you either went to mining college or you're self-taught, but we stopped teaching it. So it's not surprising that even, you know, quote unquote, well-educated Americans don't understand gold. It's routinely ridiculed on, you know, financial TV and elsewhere, but meanwhile, it goes its own way. And I think it's higher, and, you know, 2,500 is just Mick Jagger said, this is just a shout away. So, but I would expect it to be on its way to 3,000 sooner than later. The other thing, quick piece of, I always try to keep the math at the sixth grade level. There's rarely any need to go higher in terms of calculus or whatever, but people focus on the dollar increases in the price of gold. It went up $100 an ounce, or over time it went up $500 an ounce, et cetera. And that's fine, and that's real money, and that's your gain. But as the dollar price gets higher, each dollar increase represents a smaller percentage gain. Right. So, for example, if gold goes from $2,000 to $3,000 an ounce, that's a 50% increase. But if it goes from $9,000 to $10,000 an ounce, that's an 11% increase. Still $1,000. You made $1,000 an ounce on your gold stash or your gold position or whatever. It's real money, but it gets easier because the percentage gain is smaller as the denominator of the fraction increases. So what that means is this is how you get bubbles. We're nowhere near a bubble in gold, but if it gets to the blow off bubble stage, and we'll kind of keep an eye out for that down the road. But going to $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 an ounce, each $1,000 jump is easier than the one before because it's a smaller percentage jump. It goes from 50% to 30% to 20% to down to 10% or less. And so the time to get the gold is now before the rocket ship really takes off.
Exactly. Well, you know, and that's fantastic advice. And I hope all of our listeners are doing that. But dovetailing with that, so dollar's getting weaker. We're probably in a recession. Gold's rocketing. You also made a great prediction about how the bank failures will continue. I just want to get a couple ideas on that as well, because, you know, like some of those bank stocks have been pretty steadily increasing. They look all right, even though their equity would be wiped out if they were marking those treasury losses to market. So I was just wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, I think with banks, you have to sort of take a three-tiered approach. There are small community banks that are actually very sound. I do some of my banking with a bank that was founded in 1877. I figure, all right, you made it through the panic of 1907, the panic of 1898, the Great Depression, the tequila crisis, long-term capital, Russia, continental Illinois. You made it through all that, so you must be doing something right. Look at the balance sheet, do your homework, but some of those banks are just fine. Then there are the banks that are absolutely positively too big to fail. I mean, the technical term is globally systemic, important GSI institutions, and we know who they are. It's JP Morgan Chase, Citi, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, Truist. He's a dopey name, but Truist. And there are a couple others on the list, and they are absolutely too big to fail, which doesn't mean the stock price can't go down. See, that's the thing. If you're a depositor, yeah, you care about bank failures. You care about FDIC insurance and so forth. If you're a creditor, note holder, you care about all this stuff. But if you're a stockholder, you can lose a lot of money in a bank that does not fail just because the equity takes a beating. But the real vulnerability is in between, not the little guys who have been around and who pass. By the way, a ratio that very few people look at that has become very important in determining the soundness of a bank. Look at the ratio of insured deposits to total deposits, because deposits over $250,000 are not insured. Now, there's a whole bunch of technical. You can have two accounts, and you and your wife can have separate accounts, and you can go to a separate bank. There are ways to get that insured balance up into the millions if you read the fine print on the FDIC website. But it's a lot of work, and do read the fine print. But as a heuristic, as a rule of thumb, $250,000 per account in the same bank is the ceiling on deposit insurance. Well, Silicon Valley Bank, which failed in March 2023, their insured deposits were 3%. They were 97% uninsured deposits, including all the Silicon Valley startups, but some big companies as well. Cisco had an account there. One of the big Bitcoin custodians had an account there. They kept their cash there. Some of these accounts were in the billions of dollars. They were not insured. And so if there's a run on a bank and before the regulators even get out of bed, you know, depositors are taking their money out. And it's not, we all remember, you know, grainy black and white pictures from the 1930s of guys in overcoats and fedoras lined up around the bank trying to get their money before the doors closed. And usually they didn't. But the 21st century equivalent of that is someone not on a cell phone, with a cell phone, doing an online withdrawal, sending it to another account, and then texting their friends, hey, get your money out now, happening at the speed of light and with exponential impact, a little faster than word of mouth. It's like word of text. So these bank runs happen faster than anyone can contemplate. Now, what did so the vulnerabilities in the in-between, who are they? These are banks that have between roughly $200 billion and $900 billion of assets. So it's not JP Morgan, but it's not my local bank either. And I actually don't want to mention names. They're pretty easy to find the list, but everyone knows who they are. I don't want to start running any banks, but I would look at a double metric. I would look at $200 billion to $900 billion in total assets and a insured deposit to total deposit ratio of under 30%. If that's who you are extremely vulnerable. And those are the banks I would get my money out of, even though they're not technically too big to fail. They're not classified as GSIs, globally systemically important. The Fed's not going to let them fail in terms of depositors, but they will let them crash and burn in terms of stockholders. And that stock can go to zero even if the depositors are bailed out. Now, what actually happened in Silicon Valley Bank, it wasn't just Silicon Valley Bank. It was Silvergate Bank, Silicon Valley, Signature Bank, with Barney Frank on the board, by the way, our friendly bank regulator from the House of Representatives at the time. And then Credit Suisse, one of the largest, oldest banks in the world, and First Republic, which is one of the largest asset managers around. They failed in pretty close sequence, four of them within 3 weeks or less. And then the fifth one fell about a month and a half later. But what did the Fed and the FDIC do to stop that cascade of bank failures? They guaranteed every deposit in the system. They said, forget about the $250,000. We're guaranteeing everybody. They didn't do that at first, by the way, with Silicon Valley. Friday night, they said 250 is the limit. If you're over that, we're giving you as a certificate, basically. The bank had been taken over, placed in custodianship, and that we'll give you a custodian certificate, and we'll get back to you on what it's worth. We got to sell the assets first or do a merge or something. We'll get back to you. But it was illiquid. You didn't know what it was worth, and you didn't know when you were going to get paid. But your deposit was gone. That was kind of what the G7 said in Brisbane in 2014. That was the bail-in, not the bail-out. 48 hours later, they said, just kidding. All the deposits are insured. No limit. You know, it's, you know, Bill Ackman, all the Silicon Valley crybabies ran to the White House, and they got what they wanted. But they did something else. The Fed created a facility that said to every bank, if you own U.S. Treasury securities, you can borrow the face value from us, give us the securities as collateral, we'll give you the cash, a one-year loan. I'm sure the interest rate was like 1% or something like that, regardless of the fact that the securities were only worth 70 cents on the dollar. Because a lot of those securities had been bought when interest rates were 1.5%, 2%, and in the meantime, interest rates had gone to 5.5%, those bonds were way underwater, depending on the maturity, down 20 to 30%. And the Feds, and if you marked them to market, those banks would clearly have been insolvent. The Fed said, again, never mind, we'll give you 100 cents on the dollar, even if the bonds are only worth 70 cents on the dollar. I tried to find someone at the Fed I could call and see if they would take my used car on the same math, but was unsuccessful. That facility got to be several hundred billion dollars in a very short period of time, which shows how illiquid a lot of these banks were. Here's my question, Sean. When the bank crisis comes back, and I would say it never really went away, but you know, we're in a timeout, halftime, we're in the locker room, so we're going to get back on the field. When this reemerges, there'll be some catalyst for it and could be a lot of things. What else have they got in their bag of tricks? I mean, once you've guaranteed every treasury bond, regardless of market value, and you've guaranteed every bank deposit, regardless of the deposit amount, the deposit insurance, what else can you do? Well, the answer is you can nationalize the banks, but that means wiping out the stockholders. And so, again, if you're a depositor, I personally wouldn't take chances, but you may get by as they did in Silicon Valley Bank. If you're a bondholder, get ready for a haircut. And if you're a stockholder, get ready to be wiped out, because that's what will happen.
Wow, incredible stuff. Let's turn to politics, because one of your big predictions was Biden would drop out. He did. And I just want to get this straight, since I'm you know, a couple thousand miles across the pond here. So George Clooney basically hosts a fundraiser in L.A., raises $30 million for Joe Biden, and then Biden has a disastrous debate, at which point Barack Obama asked Clooney to write a New York Times, you know, article saying, could you please drop out? And then he does and endorses Kamala Harris, of all people, straight away, which I'm not so sure Barack Obama wanted him to do. And now today, which I just cracked up, I was just watching this, or was it yesterday, when he basically said that Speaker Mike Johnson is dead on arrival, not the bill to reform the Supreme Court. He's just the gift that keeps giving. I call him the abracadabra now. So he drops out, and now it's Kamala. Do you think she has a chance in November?
Well, she has a chance. I mean, my prediction. Well, by the way, I wrote in September 2023, mm-hmm. so 10 over 10 months ago, and it was the October issue, but we actually released it in September 2023, of Strategic Intelligence, which is our flagship newsletter. Mm-hmm. I said the Democrats would get rid of Biden. So our readers were among those who were unsurprised by what happened. We told them 10 months ago that this was going to happen. And it did. Now, Obama, a bit of a coward. I expect Obama would have no difficulty whatsoever getting an op-ed in the New York Times. If he wanted it, just his person could call the editor. They would be glad to publish. Instead, he gets, you know, George Clooney out there as a cat's paw, a little bit of a pawn. Clooney makes a good tequila at Casamigos, but he's obviously being used as a puppet by the neo-Marxists in Obama's Kalorama mansion. But okay, so it plays out. That came as no surprise. The timing was fascinating because they had to wait until, first of all, query whether they knew, I don't have any hard evidence for this, but the query whether they knew that Biden would do exactly what he did in the June 27th debate. They knew that he couldn't string two sentences together, but they put him out there with no teleprompter, no notes, no, you know, help me out here, Candy, you know, like, hey, Obama, and knowing he would fail. But that was the setup for what came next. That's how it played out, whether that was that cynical or not, you know, we'll have to wait to find out. But then we had the Trump attempted assassination, which obviously, you know, Biden's not going to step out of the race in the middle of that. Then on to the Republican convention and J.D. Vance. So they couldn't really start the coup d'etat, and it was a coup d'etat. I know enough history. I work for the CIA. I know a coup d'etat when I see it. That's what this was. It was nonviolent, but, well, except for the assassination, but it was a coup d'etat. But they had to wait until the Republican convention was over, but they had to do it before August 1st. So the window was really kind of July 19th to July 31st. And all right, Republican convention, why do I say July 31st? The Democratic convention starts August 19th in Chicago. That'll be a spectacle, by the way. 100,000 pro-terrorist Hamas demonstrators are going to show up. But so the Democratic convention starts August 19th. Well, why couldn't you wait another week or so? Well, the answer is that the Democrats cooked up this scheme where they're not going to vote for the nominee at the convention. They're going to do a virtual digital roll call vote starting August 1st. We're doing this on July 31st, basically starting tomorrow. The reason for it, it is like lost in the clouds of time. It had to do with an August 7th deadline in the state of Ohio. If you didn't have your nominee by August 7th, you weren't on the ballot in November. And so who figured August 19th was a good time to have a convention? They thought they could get Ohio to change it. They didn't at first, and they did. But all that's sort of forgotten. That was the ostensible reason for doing the virtual roll call August 1st, so they could beat the August 7th deadline. But it kind of morphed in the sense that, oh, gee, here's a chance, now that we're doing this, now that we kind of set it up, here's a chance to get Kamala in, nominated. We don't even have to wait till August. We don't even have to wait till the convention. I love the fact that the Democrats are running around calling Trump a threat to democracy when the Democrats are going to have a nominee who never ran in a primary, not one, in 2020 and 2024. She never got to a primary. She never got one vote, but she's going to be the nominee. Vote schmotes. And it's like, you know, who cares? That these are here are your Democrats for you. So she's in. The media can now go full cover up, you know, kind of, you know, promote Kamala's on fire. Kamala's a, you know, ball fire, high energy, getting the youth vote, you know, out on the campaign trail. Okay. She's doing all those things, but she's still a dunce. I mean, her problem is that she's a very low IQ, not very likable person. Who I read one statistic of her 71 original East Wing White House staffers, only four are still with her. The other 67 that quit or were fired. She's a screamer, terrorist, pounds the table. Not a literal terrorist, but a terrorist to work for. Terroristic, I guess. Pounds the table, screams, curses, whatever. So that's who she really is. People say, what would a Harris administration look like? I would say more Biden than Biden. It would be all the Biden policies, but worse, carried to a greater extreme. You name it: climate, immigration, open border, high taxes, more regulation, weaponizing the Justice Department, censorship, all of it. The list keeps going. That's Kamala, she'll be Biden on steroids. Biden could probably use some steroids. So that's what you're getting. Now, the question is, will she win? My forecast is still that Trump will win. The latest polls, yeah, you got to wait a week or two after these things happen to really look at the polls, in the sense that the polls lag. And a lot of these instant Kamala polls, you know, you always have to look at the press release and the cross tabs. A lot of them were registered voters. Well, that's not a reliable poll. You need what are called likely voters. If it's adults, that's garbage. If it's registered voters, 50% of the people don't vote. So you got a big skew there, people who don't care, kind of. You have to look at likely voters, number one. You have to look at the Democrat-Republican breakdown. That's another skew. You have to look at the sample size. If it's less than 1,300, your margin of error goes way up. So I don't put much weight on those early polls. But the latest ones, where they do meet the criteria I'm describing, and it's a poll of polls. This is real clear politics. So poll of polls kind of filters out noise at both extremes. It shows Trump ahead in every battleground state and ahead overall. Margins narrowed a little bit. This may all come down to Pennsylvania, and Trump's got a healthy 2.5% lead in Pennsylvania. So I would still say Trump's going to win. It is a little closer than it was, but maybe that's just to be expected. But from here, I think Trump can open up the gap again, running not against Biden, but against Kamala. And I'm particularly intrigued by the prospect of a debate, because she can't think on her feet. I mean, give her a teleprompter. Even there, she's not that good. But give her a teleprompter, she gets by. Give her softball questions that are prearranged and prearranged answers, she gets by. But extemporaneous on her feet, no teleprompter, no notes, no help me out here, get it to me. As they say, get your popcorn and enjoy, because I think the smartest thing Trump could do would be say as little as possible and just let her talk. We'll see how it goes. But right now, I would still say that Trump's going to win, but he can take nothing for granted. They got to retool the campaign. It'll be a little closer than it would have been. But again, he's still ahead in those battleground states.
Okay. Final question. With the Trump victory, where do you see... Well, God, I mean, he's going to have basically a blank check from Build Back Better money that hasn't been spent. Do we see inflation actually tick up, and do the markets follow it up or down?
There may be a short-run surge of inflation that may even happen between now and the election that will have basically nothing to do with Trump. You always get blamed for whatever happens on your watch starting on day one or sooner, but it really will have very little to do with Trump. And everything to do with Biden's fiscal stimulus, the deficits we're talking about, and some of the legislation you mentioned. Now, the economists who get everything wrong, but they're forecasting much higher inflation under Trump because he's going to throw tariffs on a lot of people, which he is. But I just wrote an article on this, a pretty long one. It'll be in the reader Q&A section of our next issue of Strategic Intelligence. So if our listeners are subscribers to Strategic Intelligence, they'll have it in their inboxes in a day or two. We're just doing the final editing right now. But I basically described the Trump economic plan in detail. And I'm calling it the American System 2.0. And that's a reference. That reference goes back to Alexander Hamilton, John Quincy Adams, Henry Clay, and Abraham Lincoln. And then later on, William McKinley, Ronald Reagan, and Donald Trump's first term, where your policy is protectionism, which is a good thing. I mean, the neoliberal globalist consensus that has prevailed really since the 1920s and on steroids, so to speak, since Bretton Woods and the Trade Reform Act of 1962 and the mission of China to the World Trade Organization in 2001. That's the globalist agenda promoted by, really starts with, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Andrew Jackson, and the Jacksonian presidents, Martin Van Buren, James Knox Polk, and then carrying on through most of the modern presidents. By the way, I would exclude Dwight Eisenhower. He was more Hamiltonian, if you will. But that debate's been going on in U.S. economic policy and politics for 235 years. It never went away, but the globalists have prevailed, and now that's about to turn 180 degrees. But you say, well, gee, aren't tariffs bad? Don't they impede free trade? Well, first of all, free trade doesn't exist. There is no free trade. Give me a break. You know, even Ricardo recognized that comparative advantage is portable. The idea was, you know, well, England's good at woolens and Portugal's good at making wine, so England shouldn't make wine and Portugal shouldn't make woolens. They should trade wine for woolens. Each has a comparative advantage and everybody's better off. Well, that's true, assuming you can't grow grapes in England and you can't start a mill in Portugal, but maybe you can. But most input factors are completely portable. Brains, intellectual property. If you steal intellectual property and attract foreign capital, what good does the U.S. comparative advantage and finance and technology do when China just steals it and the U.S. and BlackRock puts the money in? Where's your comparative advantage? It moved to the other guy. So you can create comparative advantage out of thin air and knock the heck out of somebody's domestic industries. And the answer to that is protectionism, but with a point of creating jobs, creating industry. And what Trump is going to say to the world, and by the way, the big brains behind this are Robert Lighthizer and Peter Navarro. Peter just got out of jail. He'll be back in the West Wing in a few months. So nice segue. But what they're saying to the world is, hey, if you want to sell something in the United States, that's just fine. But build it here. Put your money here, create jobs here, and build it here, and you can sell all you want. That may involve, you know, training, education. Well, those are good things. Those are good things to invest in. So I expect this, it's not just protectionist, it's mercantilist, but it's a very good system. The fall of the British Empire began with the repeal of the Corn Laws. The problem is they thought they were rich enough to be free traders and turned out to be wrong. And by the way, I recommend Peter Navarro's book, The New MAGA Deal. The New MAGA Deal. I haven't read it yet. I'm still waiting for my copy. It was kind of back ordered on Amazon, but get it, read it, if you want to understand what the Trump policy is going to look like.
Jim, all right. It was a lot longer than a half an hour, but thank you so much. As always, I can listen to you all day. That's why I never stop yet. Folks, that was the magnificent Jim Rickards. Subscribe to Strategic Intelligence if you haven't already. And if you like what you've heard here, give us a like and a subscribe, and we'll see you next time. Thank you very much.